Dave Barry, professional humorist, and the man whose unique worldview will keep you in stitches, is just out with a new title, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Dave Barry on parenting and other topics he knows very little about. We'll be speaking with Dave today about this new title. For many years, Dave wrote a newspaper column that appeared in more than 500 newspapers and which earned him a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Barry has written more than 30 books, including the novels Big Trouble, Lunatics, Tricky Business, and most recently, Insane City. He's also written a number of books with titles like I'll Mature When I'm Dead, which are technically classified as nonfiction, although, according to the author, they contain numerous lies. Welcome, Dave. It's an honor to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's an honor to be back on the Book Report.
First and foremost, I have to be serious. I live with a guy who's not prone to spontaneous outbursts of laughter. But this man laughed out loud about every minute and a half while reading your book, so kudos to you.
He sounds like he's a sick man.
Okay, one more serious note and then we'll get on with it. Has your daughter Sophie ever recovered from Justin Bieber not attending her bat mitzvah party?
No. I mean, not in the sense of, forgiving him, but she stopped loving him not long after that we went to this concert. Well, if only she'd stopped before we spent several $100,000 on tickets to go see Justin Bieber, that would have been better. But after we went to this concert here in Miami, at which she did throw her bat mitzvah invitation at his feet, literally, she decided he was a jerk. And so we're all glad he didn't come to the bat mitzvah.
Yeah, I think most of us have decided that he's a jerk.
Yes, apparently he's the only person left on the face of the earth who doesn't realize that.
Okay, in the prologue to You Can Date Boys When You're 40, you talk about judging a book by its cover.
Yes. The title of the book does suggest, and the cover of the book does suggest, that this is a book about parenting because it's called You Can Date Boys When You're 40, which is a statement I have made to my daughter more than once. She's now 14, so she's got 26 years to go before she can date. And I'll probably be dead when that happens, but I still plan to go along in an urn.
Oh. You know,
and it'll say on the side, "You kids have fun, pay no attention to me," something like that. but in fact, the book is not about parenting, even though that's what the cover would suggest. That essay is, but it's actually a series of essays on a variety of topics. I hope people realize that whatever they want to find, whatever the topic is they're interested in, it's in this book.
Absolutely. And I want to tell readers there's a great bit of historical research in your book. For example, you've uncovered the fact that no country where the masculine population wears capri pants has ever won a war.
That's correct. Yeah, I have an essay in there about manliness, how to be a man. And one of the things I say is you can't wear capri pants, even though the fashion industry, really the New York Times fashion section, decides about once every 6 months. It gets a bee in its bonnet. The capri pants are going to be in for men. And they even show photos of men wearing capri pants. Of course, these men are always models, and they don't look happy about it. They have that kind of grim model look on their face. They're being paid to wear the damn capri pants. But To the argument that, well, there are countries where men do wear capri pants, that I answered, as you say, that yes, but none of those countries has ever won a war.
Yeah, I saw three guys wearing capri pants near my home on Miami Beach. So, Dave, is it time to put the condo on the market?
They were from Europe. Or they were New Yorkers who read the New York Times fashion section and take it seriously. There's about maybe, I would say, 2 to 3 dozen men in the nation who do actually do what the New York Times fashion section says men are going to do. The rest of us don't. We continue to buy our clothes at Target.
Okay, interestingly, there's a section of the book dealing with grammar and formulating a correct grammatical sentence. And you even delve into predicates, a term which most of us have heard before, but few can explain. Why grammar? Why now?
Well, this essay on grammar is actually based on a when I wrote a regular weekly newspaper humor column, I used to write a pretty regularly a column called Ask Mr. Language Person, in which I would pretend to be an expert on language, and Mr. Language Person, And the joke was, the running joke was, that the advice I gave was horrendously wrong. It was always, you know, completely the opposite of the truth. And the what used to get me about it was when that column would run, the column would typically have 50 incorrect statements about grammar. And then I would get, people would write me, often English teachers, and say, I suppose you're not aware that when you're passing yourself as a language expert, you have actually made some, and they'll circled two of the 50 errors, having missed the other 48. So, yes, I wrote an essay on grammar, which usually people don't think of as a humor topic, but which I find pretty funny.
Yeah. Is texting the death knell of the English language?
I don't know. I mean, my daughter communicates primarily by texting. I think that if she could, she would text me even when I'm standing next to her. Does she want waffles or Fruit Loops this morning? But it certainly has changed the way people use the language, and not for the better in some ways. I mean, the spelling of texting is not acceptable. So I hope that young people figure out that they can't write that way when they're writing their job applications, but maybe they haven't. I don't know.
Yeah. You throw around some pretty heady vocabulary. For example, what is arthropodic?
I don't know. No, I make up grammar terms. I'll say, this is a marsupial phrase, that kind of thing.
I see. Okay, there's a section in the book about travel with a focus on the TSA. As one of America's funniest guys, have you ever actually joked with TSA personnel, and can you share the outcome?
Well, I came close. I have a section in here about how to take a plane, and one of the things I discuss in there is, they say you're not allowed to make inappropriate jokes around the TSA, and so I have a little chart in the book, which is which I call the official Transportation Security Administration checkpoint humor guidelines, giving inappropriate and appropriate jokes. For example, inappropriate would be, I have a bomb in my backpack. That's an inappropriate joke. An appropriate version would be, I have a bomb in my backpack. Ha ha, I am just joking around with you in an appropriate manner. Then they'll let you right through, no problem. I did once, in the Miami International Airport, when they had first installed these new scanners they have that scan an image of your naked body and then send it to a TSA agent in another room, or Facebook. We don't actually know what they do with that naked image. But the first time I went through that at Miami International Airport, they stopped me and they wouldn't let me through. They put me in this little holding area, and I asked the guy, after several minutes went by, I said, can you tell me what this is about? And he said, yeah, you have a blurred groin.
Oh!
And that's not something you want to find out at the airport.
No. Okay, I want to share this line with listeners, which references your inability to bargain while shopping in the Middle East. To quote you, I come from a long line of WASPs. Our tradition is to pay full price, then get revenge by starting an exclusive country club.
My family's wife, we don't have a tradition of bargaining. My bargaining status is usually to say, my approach, my tactic is usually to say, are you sure you're making enough money on this deal? I'm just not good at it. And in one of the essays in the book where that the bargaining comes up is, my wife and daughter and I went to Israel in last summer, and for a trip with a temple, and I bought some sandals, the cheap rubber sandals, like water shoes, in Tel Aviv from this guy, this street merchant, and it said, all the guidebooks said you are supposed to bargain, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it because I figured out that they were, $8, and that just seemed fine to me. I obviously am supposed to get him down to $3 or something like that, but I just went and paid the $8. And then when I got back to the hotel, I realized that first of all, he had charged me $8 per sandal. It turned out I didn't realize that right away because the unit of currency in Israel is shekels, believe it or not. Which I know it's a joke, but it really is what they use. And the other thing is, not only did he charge me $8 per sandal, but they were defective sandals. So I probably should have bargained.
Yeah. Well, I hope you didn't wear them when you went rappelling down the perilous cliff.
Yeah, one of the things, I did a number of things in Israel. I was terrified to go there because, you know, you'll hear the Middle East is scary and there's wars and there's tension. And actually, none of that was a problem. I mean, we saw no violence. We were fine. But I ended up getting terrified several times. One was riding a camel, which is a scary experience. One was rappelling down a cliff. And I thought, you know, it was on the list of activities, and I didn't really want to do it because I'm afraid of heights. But my daughter wanted to do it. You know, you can't, if you're a dad, tell your, she was then 13-year-old daughter, no, we can't do this because I'm afraid, you know, when she's all hot to do it. So I thought there would be some kind of, you know, concession where they would have safety nets and, you know, legal disclaimers that you sign and, you know, a staff, and they would show you a little safety video or something before they let you go off this cliff. Because it was a real cliff. I mean, it was not, you know, it was way down there. It was like the Grand Canyon. And instead, it's like one guy standing there on the edge of the cliff, really too close to the edge, if you ask me. And he's got this, like, ring bolted into the cliff. I don't know who bolted it in or how long ago. And he just basically, he puts his harness on you and says, okay, go! And you just walk backwards off this, you know, cliff. Hmm. Which, and the rabbi of the temple, Rabbi Edwin Goldberg, was with us, was our guy, you know, sort of our guy. And he went first, and he's down there, and I'm dangling over him, and I'm thinking, I wonder if it's like some kind of real serious major violation of the law in Israel to poop on a rabbi. Because I was in close, danger of losing total sphincter control up there.
I don't blame you, but I want to let the listeners know that the book includes a photo of your rappelling adventure.
Because people might not believe that I actually would do such a thing, but I did, and you can see in the book a picture of me taken by a trained ophthalmologist, I'll have you know, who's also on the trip, dangling on the side of this cliff, absolutely terrified.
But you did it, and that's what counts.
I have photographic proof in the book.
Right. So, Dave, what's next? What are you working on now?
I just finished a young adult fiction book for Disney called tentatively called The Worst Class Trip Ever.
Oh.
It's about a class trip that goes severely wrong. And then I'm working on another essay book because I had a bunch more ideas, so.
All right. Well, I think you'll have to go a long way to top this one. This was amazingly funny. Readers, you got to pick it up. Thank you, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure, Elaine. Thank you.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.